This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
After they have given us independence, we beat the communists in no time. And now we are running the country as well as you could expect it to be run.
That was Tunku Abdul Rahman, Malaysia's first Prime Minister, speaking to the Roving Report before he unveiled the White Paper on the Malaysia Plan in 1961. The document detailed points of agreements between Malaya and Singapore. 2 years later, the Federation of Malaysia was created, merging Malaya, North Borneo, Sarawak and Singapore. Another 2 years later, Singapore left the Federation to become an independent state. It's been more than five decades since the formation of Malaysia, and today we take a look back to appreciate how far the country has come since then. You're with me, Nadia Aziz, for the fourth and final episode of our Merdeka and Malaysia Day four-part special. In the late 1930s, Malaya was the resource of 40% of the world's rubber and 60% of the world's tin. Most of these commodities went to Japan's cross-ocean rival, the United States. Malaya also proved a perfect point to launch a further invasion to the oil-rich islands of Borneo, Java and Sumatra, with Japan also needing oil supplies for its military and industrial capacities. Once Japan was starved of these resources and refused supplies from the US, Britain and the Netherlands, the country looked to Southeast Asia to make up the shortfall. Being one of the richest jewels in the British imperial crown sealed Malaya's fate. December 8, 1941. Despite heavy waves and bad weather, the Japanese convoy of ships appeared on the shores of the Badang and Sabah beaches in Kota Bharu. The British Royal Air Force and Royal Australian Air Force's base of operations in northern Malaya. The Japanese landing in Kelantan proved to be a turning point, a major catalyst in both Malaysian and regional history. Zafrane Arifin from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club explains why this is so.
It happened 1 hour and 50 minutes before the attack on Pearl Harbor, which is more famous worldwide. But for this event, it's unknown because it's like being in the shadow of the Pearl Harbor event. So it's a shame to know that because it's even more important because it's the first one in the Pacific War. And so many people died, including many Japanese, hundreds of them. The Japanese should know this because it's the war that began their own Pacific War, not the Pearl Harbor attack. Many people forget about that. We are like trying to show the forgotten history. They chose to attack Kota Bharu because Kota Bharu was the focal point of the British defense, which was the Air Force. The Air Force was the main defense for the Malayan strategy. So when the Royal Air Force and Royal Australian Air Force were based in Kota Bharu, can attack the Japanese on the sea when they were approaching, that could be a very decisive moment. If the British were successful, the attack on Malaya will be resolved and Malaya will be safe. So that's why the Japanese attacked Kota Bharu first to destroy the British airfield and capture the airfield to use by their own air force to attack Singapore and elsewhere. The British had three airfields in Malaya, Kota Bharu airfield, Machang airfield and Gokodak. So these airfields are supposed to be watching over the coast of Malaya from the north where the Japanese were expected to came. So they have great defense in Kelantan, actually, all over the coast, from Tumpat to the Besut border with Terengganu. So they have about 5,000 soldiers in Kelantan.
Among the British Army ranks were soldiers from the Indian Infantry, while the Japanese invading army was made up mostly of hardened veterans from the war in China. The British held off a first and second wave of attacks, but by the end of the day, Kota Bharu had fallen. Several attempts throughout the day to retake the area also failed. Quite frankly, the British were outmaneuvered.
Because the width of the beach defence is so long, they have fewer men to man all the defence line. So that means the defensive line were thinner than supposed to be. When the Japanese attack with great numbers at one point, they can penetrate through superior number. So that's why they managed to be victorious in Kota Bharu. They see the ship were coming from the South Vietnam towards Kota Bharu, but because at the time they were on the declaration of war, so they can't do anything. If they attack first, they would be doing something wrong without international declaration of war. So they were unable to do anything. But the Japanese, they were so sure about winning the war, so without declaration of war, they just attack, and that's why they win. If they lost this attack, the empire will lose the war.
The Japanese had prepared in advance for the invasion, setting up local agents in strategic locations. By proposing independence from their colonial masters, the local Malays were easily roped in, while simultaneous attacks ensured no reinforcements came.
Actually, the Japanese have some spies networked in Malaya at the time. Mostly, they were selling food to the locals, barber. Nobody suspect that they are actually spies. And they also, of course, recruit the local because they want to get their assistance. And they also want the people to realize that they are fighting for their own freedom. They were just being used, actually. The Japanese plan to attack the entire Pacific War at the same time, one of the reasons is to cause confusion for the allies, you know. They didn't know how to react. Is it the actual attack? Because there were no declaration of war. So when the surprise attack happened everywhere in the Pacific, they were shocked and cannot react. So that's why they were beaten in Pearl Harbor. They were smashed in Pearl Harbor and Hong Kong, everywhere, even Thailand, especially in Malaya, in Kelantan.
During the four-year Japanese occupation, the invading army's brutality would see an estimated 100,000 people killed. Decades later, the Japanese still remember their part in the war, despite the time period being glossed over in the country's history books.
Some group, including Professor Takeshima, he brought many Japanese teachers to show them the Japanese cruelty in Malaya by showing all the graves where they massacred the people here. They came, and when they go back to Japan, they teach their children or their students what really happened. Some of them, their family came to Kota Bharu to pray for their father's spirit. And also some other historians who are more nationalist in spirit, not to support the war, but to support their own country during the war, because they are supposed to be nationalistic. Some Japanese come here to apologize for what their forefather did to the country and the people here. So I work with all sides of the Japanese society.
Back in Malaysia, Zafrani laments that many Malaysians are losing their touch with this part of our history.
My parents used to be in the war, and we grew up listening to their wartime experience. It's so thrilling to listen to their stories, all the hardships. But the later generation, they are more distant because, you know, their age difference is very far apart, and they're disconnected with the people who were in the war. So it was like an old story for them and not connecting to them at all. So what I'm trying to do is to find a way to connect this generation with their historical past. The British had three airfields in Malaya. Two of them are preserved because one of them is the Kota Bharu Civil Airport, which are now still being used by the local airliners, so it's preserved, including the pillbox around the Kota Bharu Airport now. You can see this British defense structures. And at the Gongkuda Airfield, it's preserved because it is now our Royal Malaysian Air Force base there, which based the Sukhoi fighter planes. Only at Machan it's not preserved, and because it's now being developed into housing. But because of this, we can go into Machang Airfield, former airfield, to find all these relics forgotten behind some people's house, everything. So that's how we managed to find and recover all these war relics. And still, at that place, there are bomb craters from the first Japanese air raid in Malaya. We still have about three bomb craters beside the houses.
Now, it's been widely said that appreciation of history is low in Malaysia, no thanks to an uninspiring presentation of the subject in school. Memorization of dates and events take precedence over understanding the past and all the pain and suffering of the previous generations. Zafrani explains there is another way to generate interest in historical events and places. is part of a local group of history enthusiasts which conduct reenactments of World War II events in Malaya. Zafrani explains that to create an authentic experience, much research is needed beforehand, and this helps create better awareness and helps them understand better. These reenactments have been done for a number of reasons, including the filming of documentaries, but also because they enjoy doing it.
So we had to borrow the army's weapon and everything. But at the same time, we interact with the public around us. And this gave me the opportunity to tell the people about the war and history of our country during the war. So I was doing for the documentary for the History Channel. So when we go to the site, I invite other people who like war history to wear the Japanese army uniform. So we get together and it spread out, you know. People like to do this thing, exciting. While doing this in Selangor, Jandabai, during the shooting of the documentary of History Channel, people were shocked to see us guarding the old roads. They thought they were seeing Japanese ghosts. Actually, I do it mostly because I love history and I also wanting to write a book about this. So when I was wearing this uniform, I can feel how the soldiers were, you know, experiencing the war, not just reading a book. Reading a book doesn't give me that perspective. When you wear the uniform, you go into the jungle, you can see how this, the advantage of having this uniform compared to the British one. The British one have a lot of more uniform. They were so heavy that they cannot move into the jungle very easily. So we know through this thing how the battle took place, the experience of the soldier at the time. So we can say, this is why the British lost and why the Japanese won. We find out more about the uniform, everything, and it gave me also opportunity to do research, because once we found the relics, we can see, oh, these are the British Army's equipment, everything, we can identify it, because we are using this during the reenactment, so we know this is the wartime relics. We can identify easily.
This is Zafrani's suggestion for the local education system to get Malaysian children excited about bygone eras.
Like in other countries, people do this in classroom. You know, that's how they teach history to the children more effectively, wearing army uniform and fighting mock battles on the battlefield. You know, that's how you're supposed to teach history. It's more fun and. When you like to do something, people will love to do it and learn more about it. So I think we should teach history this way, actually, in schools especially.
One of the highlights of the group's calendar is the reenactment of the Battle of Kuala Pahamat in Kota Baru, that fateful day on December 8, 1941, the starting point of the Japanese occupation of Malaya. It was a period that would change the country forever. Thanks for listening to the fourth and final episode of our four-part special for Merdeka and Malaysia Day. If you missed the earlier shows, you can download the podcasts at our website www.bfm.my. This is Nadia Aziz wishing you happy Malaysia Day on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.